Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
All right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show.
It's even hard for us.
I know. It's a terrible name. We should do something different. But we've gone
too far. It's very Googleable.
It is very Googleable.
If you can spell it.
Our Twitter handle is very simple. It's just @CGSPod. Uh-huh. So that's much easier. You don't have to type the whole thing in. Actually, the whole thing doesn't fit. I tried making that the Twitter handle.
I have that same problem with important little games.
Oh, yeah.
That's why it's important games, which I feel a little badly about. The little is what mitigates the pompousness of importance. But anyway.
Yeah, you have to humble brag every time you put out a tweet, right?
Yep, every single one.
But anyway, we've got a special guest on.
Super special guest.
do we call you like a father of the indie movement in Chicago?
I prefer like his strange uncle.
Same
uncle
generation. You seem a
dark lord
to
of
me.
The dark lord of the Chicago indie scene.
Ooh, I like that even better. It sounds more menacing than a strange uncle.
But yeah, we've got Craig Stern on, and you have a couple big announcements about Telepath Tactics.
Yes, sure, I do. So, first big announcement, I made this announcement like a week ago, but whatever, I'll make it again.
Our audience doesn't know.
Yeah, that's true. They follow Gamepreneurs. What do they Telepath Tactics, indie strategy RPG, it's going to release on April 16th, 2015. I'm super excited about that because I've been working on the game for, like, roughly forever, and I really want to get done with it.
Yep.
Other cool thing is, this was just announced today, so this is actual news. Telepath Tactics is going to be shown in the Indie Mega Booth at PAX East in a couple of weeks.
Woo!
Woo!
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Why don't we just start there? Maybe you can dig into a little of, like, how you got started in the indie scene and how Telepath Tactics kind of got into the state that it's in now. Because as you said, you've been working on it for forever. So
it's like almost
kind of
a sequel, right?
I don't know, a thematic
it's
spiritual
cousin?
Right?
It's,
spiritual sequel?
It's kind of. I mean, it's in the same universe as most of my other games. So in that sense, it's a sequel, but you know, it's a very different game than any of the other games I've made as well. So, I mean, we can talk about that.
Yeah, let's go. Start from the beginning.
All right, so how I became an indie...
Tiny baby. I'm just kidding.
I was born just a little baby. okay, so, let's see. I guess this starts... I mean, if you really want to go back to the beginning, I guess this starts when I was, like, a kid. Like, maybe, like, fourth grade, something like that. I started off making, like, little board games and card games, and actually made, like, a pen and paper RPG in high school. Just, like, things to entertain myself, because I lived in Nashville, Tennessee, and no offense to anyone who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, but holy shit, is that a boring place to grow up. Especially, I should preface that, really, by saying Nashville, Tennessee in the 1990s. Horribly boring. No internet... No, I mean, you know, if you didn't have a car, you were basically screwed. Like 90% of the city has no sidewalks. It's basically a mini LA in terms of layout. You have to take interstate to get anywhere. It's just a terrible, terrible place to grow up, especially if you're a wee little nerd like I was. So, you know, I would make games to entertain myself, like board games and card games and whatnot. And, you know, I was a huge Magic the Gathering fan.
I
loved Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. That was my jam. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I made this... I made, like, a few, like, board games and card games, and I made this pen and paper RPG in high school called Epic RPG. And I distinctly remember when Unreal Tournament came out and I found out that the designer
Epic
of that
game.
Was called Epic Mega Games. I was like, damn it, they stole my name. Which is like a stupid thing to think, but I did think
you
that.
You hear that, Cliffy B? We're coming for you.
Yeah. So anyway, that was how it started out. I actually got like a scholarship to college in part based on like showing them my pen and paper RPG system.
Wow.
They were like they were impressed by that shit back in like, you know, 1999 or whatever it was that I was applying. So
what was your major?
I ended up majoring in English creative writing.
Interesting.
So, like, fun fact, the game design program did not exist. I went to the University of Southern California, which, like, has a well-known game design program.
Now.
Yeah, now.
Fast forward 20 years, you know, whatever.
Yeah, they didn't even have the game design minor at the time. Like, after I graduated, like, a year or two, that was when they first announced the minor.
I'm in the exact same boat with, like, I went to NYU, and now they have, like, again, like, one of the top three. I mean, USC, NYU have really big, like, prestigious game design programs, but only after we are gone.
So, man. So, you know, when I went there, I did, in fact, end up taking a game design class. They were just offering it as, like, a random thing in the, like, interactive whatever. I don't even remember what department it was at the time. But it was taught by Chris Swain and Tracy Fullerton.
Nice.
And if Tracy Fullerton sounds familiar, it's because she's one of the head honchos of Indiecade today. And I really liked it. It actually was...
She's making the game Walden, which is really awesome. It's like it's a Walden simulator.
Is it like a one-room escape game, like you're walled in?
No. Puns.
Sorry, I like to pun.
Craig does this. If you follow his Twitter, they're there all the time.
anyway, yeah, no, but this was actually, like, in some ways kind of formative for me, because we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, determinism and luck in games, and it helped me to kind of crystallize a lot of my thinking about strategy in games. I actually developed a board game for, like, my final project in that class that I still want to make, like, a video game out of at some point.
Nice.
Yeah, it's interesting. On our last episode, we had a guy named Rob Zubek, who was my TA for my game design course at Northwestern, which was very formative for me, too, because it kind of opens you up to thinking about game design more as kind of a systems type thing, as opposed to just building narrative and maybe, like, linear story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you start considering, like, okay, if this if I put this in, what are the repercussions on the gameplay from this mechanic, and how does it affect the player, that type of stuff, so...
Yeah, that's all very relevant. All very relevant. So anyway, so at the same time that this is all happening,
okay,
right?
Uh-huh.
Flash is big. Like, I remember being
in
the dorms back in college, and this is like, you know, 2000, 2001, being in the dorms, and like, we're watching, like, you know, Rataskull and Devil Doll, and like, just these... But like Lobster Magnet, just these insanely old Flash animations, which at the time we just thought were hysterically funny. And I eventually stumbled onto the site newgrounds.com.
Yep.
And I just loved the site. You know, it had all these great animations, it had these fun games you could play, and it kind of planted the seed in my head that, you know, this is a thing. You can make games and, like, you know, people can play them on, you know, sites like Newgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, flash forward to 2006. I graduated college. You know, huge surprise. Turns out there are no jobs for creative writing majors. and, you know, I'm sick of doing these sort of, like, menial secretary jobs. So, I apply to law school.
Okay.
You know, I take the LSAT, I get a good score, I get offered a scholarship to law school, I'm like, sweet. So I've got like 3 months to go before law school starts. And I have this hankering. I really want to make a video game. I'm like, you know, when I enter law school, I'm not going to have time to do anything other than study and be boring. And I really just want to have one last big creative project before I enter law school, and I've decided that teaching myself to make a video game is it. That's what I'm going to do.
You're having an intellectual bachelor party for yourself.
Yes. Yes. With lots of naked dancing code.
The best kind of parties.
So, I obtain a copy of, I think it was like Flash 8 at that time, or something ridiculous. And I just find a bunch of free tutorials online, and bit by bit, I teach myself how to code badly, and I make a game. And that was Telepath RPG Chapter 1, which I released like a couple weeks before I entered law school. And nice. You can still find it and play it. I don't advise it. It's a terrible game. But that was sort of how I started. Is, you know, I made that, and I was like, okay, it's law school, first semester. I have to buckle down. I have to get crazy good grades because reasons. I'm not going to make games. So, you know, first semester goes by. At the end of the semester, I'm like second in my class. Things are great. But then I'm like, kind of want to make another game. And I'll make another game. So I get started on what ends up being Telepath RPG Chapter 2. It takes me 9 months. Grades my second semester are not nearly as good. But I have birthed...
Worth it.
Yeah, I have birthed this little baby game, Telepath RPG Chapter 2, and it's an awesome game. I'm still proud of it. The fact that I was able to accomplish it, knowing as little about coding as I did, is kind of amazing.
I gotta go spelunking in the internet and find these games. Because I will gain some deep insights into the mind of Craig Stern.
That's possible. You might.
There's absolutely something to be said for just the sheer ignorance of when you first get into making games. You just say, you know what? I can do this, right? I got this. And then it's only later on you discover how hard it is. But sometimes, you know, just having that ignorance is like, it kind of propels you forward because you go, how hard can it be? And then, you know, you actually get something done. The fact that you made and released a game in 3 months blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it's very short and really bad. But I did do it.
Yeah, getting to release is a huge thing. Like,
have you heard of the cult of Dunn?
No.
It's a thing that it's spread around by the NYC Resistors, who are like this hardware hacking collective in New York, and they basically have this manifesto of many items, and basically the gist of it is. Dunn is more important than any other feature of the thing that you create. So, like, perfect is the enemy of Dunn, and, you know, lots of other wisdom. I highly recommend.
So, if it's your first night at NYC Resistor Club, do you have to release something?
Yeah, I mean, and they also say that, like, putting something. Like writing your idea and putting it on the internet is like the cousin of Dunn.
Because you're accountable.
If you don't, no, because not claiming that you will do something, but just be like, it would be great if somebody made a movie where blah blah blah, and just like write that and put it on the internet, and now that statement is done.
There's something to be said for hitting publish on blog posts, right? Because
yeah, yeah.
I probably have like 5 blogs in queue. That, like, I go and I deal with, and I never actually get finished, right? And you don't really build anything until you release stuff. Now, you can release terrible stuff, but I think even that, right, at least gets you pushing in the right direction, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, all right, so now we're up to, like, 2007 on the timeline here. That's when I released Telepath RPG Chapter 2. 2008, I think, is when I discovered TIG Source. Mm. That was when I signed up for TIG Source. And I think that's when I really, like, fully became aware of indie as a thing.
Mm.
Like, before that point, I'd been making games for, I guess, years, really. And, you know, I'd put out a couple of indie games that had been reasonably well-received. But I didn't know that indie was a thing in and of itself. And it was kind of like, you know, going on the boards and... you know, reading stuff that, like, Derek Yu posted and other people posted, where I was like, oh, I'm that thing. Okay.
Yeah, this is my tribe, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I gradually integrated into that community. At the time, and, you know, not to say this isn't still the case, but at the time, there was such a huge aversion to Flash that... Like other indies wouldn't even accept you into the scene as, like, an indie developer, so I...
There's still a bit of a stigma.
There is. You know, not entirely undeserved, but, you know. So, all right, so that's 2008. I continued to make games. I guess 2010, that was when I went to my first Indie City Games meeting.
Okay.
I just kept going to all the meetings that, and for those of you who aren't familiar, Indie City Games is like the Chicago area indie developer meetup. It was started by Aaron Robinson and Scott Roberts, and I just learned Jen Frank recently, apparently, was also
one
of the founders. I didn't realize this, but apparently that was also a thing, which is kind of mind-blowing and makes me sad that I never actually met her.
It's but, not too late.
Yeah, I don't know. She is out of the industry, technically.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was sort of terrorized out by Gamergate.
Rough.
Yeah, it's sad. Anyway, so I went to like every meeting, and you know, Scott was pushing for more people to join the board, and I was like, all right, I'll do it. So I joined the board, and then gradually over time, I was like increasingly the only one actually pushing to like organize the meetings, and then I was the only one who was available to run the meetings, and then I just became the guy who organizes and runs all the meetings.
Yeah. We should get... I don't know if you have a formal title, but we should give you one.
President? El Presidente? How about that?
Yeah, I love it.
Nice. I still like the Dark Lord metaphor. You know, you're killing off everyone before you and assume the mantle, so let's go with that. Where can we find more info on it?
IndieCityGames.com, I believe, is technically the place to go. Although if you search for Indie City Games on Facebook,
that's
I think
a lot
that's,
more active. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's actually being updated right now.
Yeah, and the meetings are really fun. Anyone can show up, and you know, people will give a talk, show insight, and then do demo stuff. So it's a really like fun, informal gathering that anyone can show up to.
Yeah,
it's like the premier playtest location too for like indies working on whatever.
That's true. Yeah.
Sometimes the first look is at Indie City Games. Like, I don't know. A few prominent games got shown for I think in front of civilian eyes for the first time at Indie City Games.
Yeah, we encourage people to show like you know early versions of their games and get feedback, and a lot of folks do that. So I've seen some pretty cool stuff shown there. I've been like, whoa, where did that come from?
Yeah, I remember seeing Octodad there for the first time. Which was just
Even the student project was shown there.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, you should come. It's a great place to play games.
I don't care how long you have to drive or how many of your airline points you need to use. Come to Indie City Games meetup.
Okay, so you have assumed the mantle of Dark Lord of Indie City Games.
Yeah, so, and that same year, I'm now remembering, that was also the year I started IndieRPGs.com. Because at the time, I was dissatisfied with the coverage of indie RPGs out on the internet. Very few places at that time were covering indie games. And the places that were, by and large, just didn't cover RPGs at all. Like, if you were a platformer, they would totally cover you. If you were a puzzle game, they'd probably cover you. If you were an adventure game, sure, why not? RPG? Eh. We're not going to cover you. That was the attitude of like every site at the time that covered indie games. And I was like, this is bullshit.
It is bullshit.
Total bullshit. How can you just not even cover an entire vibrant genre of indie game?
Yeah.
So I started the Indie RPGs blog to make up for it.
Do you think that's still true?
Not as much anymore now. Indie RPGs, the prominent ones at least, get covered in a lot of different places now. And that's a big improvement from where it was 5 years ago. But, you know, the little ones, the obscure ones, still have trouble getting attention. And, you know, I think IndieRPGs.com still serves a purpose in bringing those to light.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I can almost see the sort of cost-benefit analysis of, like, traditional games journalists. Not that traditional games journalists really means anything, but but if you're in this sort of ecosystem of game reviewers, they get paid basically per review, and RPGs are known for not being the shortest games. So in terms of just like calculating how am I going to eat this month, you know, doing a couple of RPGs versus like 100 infinite runners.
That's true, although you also have to, you know, weigh that calculus against how am I going to not kill myself this month?
Yeah.
Right. And if I had to survive by playing 100 infinite runners, I would probably just end it.
Yeah, I mean, the people who are primarily reviewers, not just like industry journalists or whatever, but mostly do reviews, are often pretty depressed about the situation.
This is my life now, infinite runners. Infinite runners to review, I mean.
Yes.
Not to knock infinite runners. I feel like I accidentally insulted a friend of mine who posted on Facebook about how he had been working on an infinite runner for 3 years, and I was like, 3 years? An infinite runner?
Just crank
infinite.
That stuff out, man. I guess, yeah, if you're scripting the whole thing. Nothing's procedural in my infinite runner.
That's right.
I need total control.
Pathways. do you have a Steam curation for indie RPGs? I'm just curious.
I do. I'm not as diligent about putting stuff in it as I'd like to be, just because, you know, I have too much shit on my plate is really what it comes down to. I've got a day job. I'm working on Telepath Tactics. I've got IndieRPGs.com. I, you know, every couple months I'm expected to organize, you know, and run an Indie City Games meeting. And, you know, on top of that, I, you know, have friends and, like, a girlfriend and stuff. So, you know, that all very quickly eats up all my time. And as you mentioned, RPGs take a really long time to play through.
Yep.
And I don't want to just stick stuff on the curation page just because it looks cool. Like, I want to actually play it and be able to say, hey, I played this and it's really good.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, you know, it has some games on it, but it's not as perhaps comprehensive as I'd like it to be.
Mm.
Maybe one day, you know, when I have a game that's really successful and I'm able to take some time off, I'd like to just play a bunch of games and get caught up on all that.
Mm.
Well, we'll link it up anyway. The reason I mention it is we've thought about doing a Steam curator for just the games we discuss on the show. So
that's a cool idea.
If, you know, how the experience was. So we'll definitely take a look at it.
Awesome.
And then your latest, the Telepath Tactics.
Yeah.
I think we're about there, right?
Yeah.
So you've done, I mean, it seems like a lot of this stuff has, like, that you've talked about so far has been about sort of finding yourself within the community of game developers and your sort of place there. But it also has the side benefit of, like, building an audience for your work. How have you been sort of building anticipation for Telepath Tactics?
Well, once a week I do an interpretive dance.
Yes, I remember this. It's right next to the bean.
Yeah, yeah.
AKA Cloud Gate.
Yeah, it's a... No, I don't do that. As you mentioned, I do kind of have a built-in audience just by, I guess, by virtue of having all these roles that, I guess, people pay more attention to me because of. But, you know, it's also a huge time suck, so I don't know that it necessarily is worth it in that sense. But, yeah, I mean, what I do to get attention is first of all, with this...
It seems like you've been doing PAX for a really long time.
I have, and the only reason I'm able to afford to do that is because I had a successful Kickstarter, and...
We should talk about the Kickstarter.
Well, let me just take this opportunity to give a shout out to everyone who backed me on Kickstarter.
Yep.
Because, holy shit. Let me tell you something. Telepath Tactics would be a sopping wet pile of poop compared to what it is right now if it weren't for you.
We'll bleep that.
We have a great production team. It's not a problem. Go for it.
Excellent.
Go wild.
In fact, here's me just saying the word poop, so you can put that over it. Poop! No, hold on. Don't laugh. Poop! There we go. If they don't edit this, it'll be even funnier.
Up to you guys.
So yeah, I mean, that's what's allowed me to do any of that. So, yeah, I've been to PAX a couple times with the Indie Mega Booth. This is going to be my third and final time in PAX East coming up. And that has definitely helped me to reach fans. You know, Twitter has been obviously instrumental in helping me reach fans. I also do just a lot of writing about games and about Telepath Tactics, and you know, there's the monthly updates that I post, and then you know, I send out emails to all the members of the press who I think would be interested. Every time I post a monthly update, summing things up. You know, I spend a lot of time collecting images and creating animated GIFs and things from, you know, my progress to kind of spice it up and make it so that you're not just reading a deadly boring list every time you look at it. I've, you know, for years now, I've been writing articles about game design, sort of promoting my own personal philosophy and, you know, sort of responding to views that I see, you know, promulgated by other developers or sometimes members of the press. And, you know, those I will, like, send... I'll like submit to, you know, Rock Paper Shotgun's Sunday Papers, and sometimes they pick that up. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of different ways to kind of get yourself mm-hmm. out there and get attention for yourself as a designer.
Yeah, it feels like you don't really have a big marketing spend, right? A lot of this is just you being grassroots,
organic.
Yeah, finding you know, people that you can talk to for free and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, PAX is my only significant marketing mm-hmm. spend. Everything else, I'm mostly just relying on free stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, like, the strategy that you do is exactly what indie, like, Bootstrap should do. Just write a lot, become a voice of a community like you are for indie RPGs, become a voice in the developer community, you know, just
like,
by,
locally. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then just, talk about your game. Do monthly updates. I'm terrible at it. Because I'll get into a good rhythm, and then I miss one, and then I go, oh, I got to put more stuff in the next one. And then it's 3 months later, I'm like, oh, shoot, I haven't done an update for 3 months. So. But your updates are on sinisterdesign.net?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, I would recommend people go check that out, because, as you mentioned, there are GIFs, and the GIFs are great. They're so much fun. I just, like, this afternoon, I went through, like, 1 through 5, and just to see, like, the little GIFs and stuff. So it's really well done.
There's also some great... So, yeah, when you mentioned, like, articles responding to people's opinions, it brings to mind one of your blog posts that defines indie. And I'm sure this is, like, one of the most viewed things that you have. Because, you know, it's become a cliche that, like, you know, what is indie? What does it mean? Like, you know... Is if you have a publisher, can you be indie? Can you be indie if you know, spend $1 million on your game? So, but you have a very precise definition, which I think is pretty close to the truth. That, you know, from my perspective, do you want to tell people what indie is?
Oh God!
Indie.
Do I have this committed to memory? I'm gonna try to ad lib it enough.
Yeah, paraphrase.
Sorry, am I not supposed to curse like at all?
Oh, we'll figure it out.
It's
okay.
Fine.
All right. Sorry. I naturally just curse a lot. That's my family's from New York, originally, so it just comes naturally.
It's genetic. It's New York or genetic has made you curse on this podcast.
All right. An indie is someone who... Well, first of all, I should preface this by saying I don't define indie in terms of people or studios, because that to me is not interesting. That's like not an interesting question. Are you indie? Who gives a crap? Like, a studio can make games with publishers, they can make games independently with a small team, they can do both, and why would you bother trying to peg them as one or the other? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't matter to me. So, like, to me, if you say I'm indie, all that means is I exclusively make games with an indie development style. Now, as for what makes a game indie, that's the subject of the blog post. And my definition for that, as I recall it, is an indie game is a game that's made without a publisher. And for purposes of being indie, what matters is that it's developed without a publisher. If a publisher comes in later and says, hey, we're going to help you distribute this game you've now finished making in exchange for a small cut, I don't care about that. That's cool, because they're not influencing the actual game as it's being made.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there's that. It's also, the other two requirements are, so number two, it can't require, it can't rely on licensed IP,
mm-hmm, okay,
intellectual property, because then you're beholden to the owner of the IP. Right, they can come in and force you to make changes to make you sort of accord with the license.
Mm.
And my concern here is primarily creative freedom and authorship. And that brings us to the third requirement, which is it has to be made with a small team. Because if it's made with too large of a team, then you lose that sense of authorship. You know, like, if you're making Assassin's Creed Unity, you're talking about a game made with 9 development studios and literally thousands of developers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how could any one person feel a sense of ownership over the final product when what they've done is, like, modeled 20 different chairs, you know? Like, it's just, there's not that sense of authorship that's necessary for a game to be...
So, like, make your parents play it, and then as they go by, like, that's one of my chairs! Mom, that's one of my chairs!
I read an article this week from Harvard Business Review that said a team in the sense that we think a team, right, where there's, like, a shared, like, group responsibility, where everyone's engaged, where everyone feels, like, responsible to the outcome, can only be from, I think, 2 to 25 people. And at that point, it stops becoming a team and is more kind of like a collective work group or something like that. But you're really not, it's not a team in the sense that you kind of build these like strong interconnectedness.
Mm.
Because, you know, a company always, big companies call themselves teams, but that at that point it feels kind of sarcastic almost. Right? It doesn't mean anything, right?
Yeah, and then they'll have like interdepartmental warfare basically amongst this, we're all on the same team, but... If you take my budget resources,
so I mean, it's kind of like if you think about like at a party, if, like a group of people you talk to. I mean, really, the max is about a dozen that you can talk to at the same time. And if it gets bigger than that, then you kind of split off into subgroups. So I think just naturally as humans, like the concept of team only extends so far.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. That's a similar number to when Google did research about like at what point do engineers need managers. That's a very similar number. It was,
mm-hmm,
like in that a dozen to two dozen range. After that, you start to need a manager.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I seriously just guesstimated the number 24. It's like, let's just say that's the upper bound for how big the team can be and the game still be indie. So I'm glad I apparently guessed well that article.
Your guess is backed up by science.
Yeah, and there's also something that says, like, the number of, like, people you would consider close friends is about that number, too.
Hmm.
So it's a very, like, organic kind of conclusion that we come to on that.
Cool.
I hope Kyle Bailey doesn't listen to this. He'll probably, rage quit or something.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Tom Eastman from,
mm-hmm,
Trinket, we're just talking about how, like, how much we agree with this definition. I hope I'm not speaking for him too much there, but yeah, it's just commonsensical. And of course, you're not saying that there's, like, hard lines between indie and not indie games where, you know, you can say, like, oh, we added an artist, now we're not indie anymore.
We had this part-time guy in China. Oh, we're 25 and a half. Oh.
but just, like, as a sort of mean point for a normal distribution around the concept of indiness, yeah, I think it works really well.
Yep. So we do a lot of stuff with Kickstarters on the show. Your Kickstarter was actually one of the ones that I kind of looked at when I was starting mine. So maybe you could just share a little about like how that went, what you learned, what went well, what didn't go well, all that.
I mean, you did it twice.
Yes.
So
first time didn't go so well. Second time went super well.
Mm-hmm.
First time I did it was December 2012. And that didn't go so well for a few reasons. One was I didn't really understand what my fan base wanted out of the game.
Okay.
I had this idea that I was going to make Telepath Tactics a local multiplayer game, primarily, and I would throw in a campaign just to satisfy like long-term fans who really wanted something single-player.
Mm.
And I grossly underestimated the extent to which people who like strategy RPGs just want to sit at home and play by themselves. like people during the campaign, people got super psyched about the single player campaign. They got really super psyched about mod support, and like there were like a handful of people who were like, "Yay!" for the local multiplayer. But for the most part, like
there was much rejoicing.
Yeah. It didn't. It was not the selling point that I thought it was.
Interesting.
Yeah. I friggin' love local multiplayer, and you know the thought of being able to have friends over and just play head to head, like in this you know tactics campaign, you know seemed compelling to me. But my audience disagreed, and that was reflected in the numbers. So that's problem number one. Probably the even bigger miscalculation I made though was doing it in December, which is terrible for a whole host of reasons. First reason being that no one has any money. It's Christmas time. People have spent all their disposable income on presents. And,
or travel.
Or travel, or both. Mm-hmm. And they just, you know, most people just don't have the money to throw out your game at that point in time. Second problem with doing Kickstarter in December is journalists are on vacation. They're not writing articles during most of December. They just have their like little like best of the year lists saved up to post that they wrote in November, and that's pretty much all they're going to be posting.
Mm-hmm.
So, no one has any money, and you will get no coverage. Just don't
stay
do
away from December.
In December, yeah.
I mean, it's a good note about press because I ran my Kickstarter in a time frame that coincided with PAX East. And while PAX East was going on, it was complete radio silence.
Mm.
And then for probably another 3-4 days after, everyone was busy doing their write-ups from PAX East, so I couldn't get any coverage in that time frame either. I know it's hard to dodge all the major cons, but do your best to try to get around them.
No, but you weren't at PAX East, right?
No, I wasn't at PAX East.
Okay, so yeah, so definitely if you're not at PAX, don't do a Kickstarter during PAX.
Right, yes.
I was actually able to make PAX East work for me the second time I ran the Kickstarter when you run a Kickstarter, right, you have about a week mm-hmm. where people are excited, they're you know throwing money at you, you're like, yeah, I'm gonna totally hit my goal, and then it just goes
right,
like
yeah.
and then it just kind of plateaus,
then there's the valley,
yeah,
yep.
So I knew because I had done this once before that that was gonna happen, so the second time I ran the Kickstarter I timed it so that about 1 week into the campaign, I would be at PAX East in the Indie Mega Booth,
and I
was able to get a bump from that, which was very helpful towards you know sustaining the campaign and helping it to be even more successful. So, if you can get into the Indie Mega Booth, consider timing your campaign like that. Otherwise, yeah, steer clear of PAX.
And there are other like ways you can get into different conventions and stuff like that. It doesn't necessarily have to be PAX or PAX East, but you know, getting some coverage in that kind of middle span is super important.
And the easiest way to do that is to be at a place where
journalists are yeah.
in meat space. Like, so you can grab their shoulder and spin them around and say, here's my game.
Although I will say, even if you don't get coverage during the middle period, it's super important to A, not panic, and B, keep posting updates.
Mm.
Yep.
Because the thing is, even if it's quiet during the middle period, and it usually is for Kickstarters, things pick up during the final week. But if people come in and check it out in the final week, and it's just a ghost town, you haven't posted anything for 2 weeks, that's going to look sketchy, and people are not going to feel heartened by seeing that,
right.
They're going to be less likely to throw money at you.
Yep, I agree. And you'll pick up some people in the 2 weeks, right? You'll get maybe like couple people, you know, maybe like every half day or something like that. It's worth it just to...
It's incubating almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like the period where you're not showing symptoms, but the disease is still there.
Strange.
But it's a good disease. It's a money disease.
Yes. The disease of support from your adoring public.
And the other thing is, you know, journalists are busy too, right? And it may take them a week or more for them to kind of get through their mailbox, find your stuff, and actually post something up. So the sooner you kind of get on there and keep, you know, letting them know that stuff is happening, the better your chance that they'll actually get to it and put something that you can...
And that's actually a super good thing to remember in general. I you know, in general, I have this, like, weird part of my personality where, like, if people don't respond to me for a while, I'm like... They hate me. They don't even like me. I know it. Yeah. I just have this like little voice in the back of my head that does that sometimes. But running IndieRPGs.com has been incredibly helpful for me in having the perspective to be like, no, Craig, actually, you do that too. You have emails that have been sitting in your inbox for weeks that you just haven't gotten to.
Yeah.
And it's not because you hate the person. And it's not because you're never going to cover their game. You just haven't had time to give it its proper consideration. And, you know, journalists are busy. You have to keep it in mind.
Mm. I think the hard part is when you're running the Kickstarter, you are thinking about nothing but the Kickstarter, like, 24/7. And when something doesn't happen right away, that feels like a million years in your Kickstarter time. It's like, this guy has to write me back in an hour. What is happening? What is wrong? And then it's really about you just gotta step back and realize that other people are not running a Kickstarter right now. Their lives run on normal time schedules, and just be patient. Be patient and just trust that some things will come through.
I have some money questions because this is the Gamepreneur show.
Yeah, I'll give him a shot. A money shot.
Whoa. I don't know. We might have to bleep that too. So, aside from your Kickstarter funds,
mm-hmm.
are you using any other... sources of funding?
Yes.
Are you also
my savings?
How much have you had to dip into your savings? You don't have to say if you don't want to. Any and all questions are optional.
Oh no, it's fine. I mean, I'm going to be posting a blog post with all the numbers in great detail once Telepath Tactics is out, anyway. So I don't mind saying, counting this PAX East, I'm probably going to have spent in total somewhere a little north of $12,000 of my own money, in addition to the Kickstarter funds, to get Telepath Tactics done.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
Do you have projections about sales?
I mean, I'm projecting my anxieties onto them.
What marketplaces are you going to be on?
So, it's going to be on Steam.
I actually know the answer to this question, but...
Yeah, it's going to be on Steam, it's going to be on GOG.com, and I'm also going to sell direct through my website. I ran the numbers, and I have to sell somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 copies to recoup my out-of-pocket expenses, and for me to...
Piece of cake, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super easy.
I genuinely think so.
Yeah, I actually generally concur that you'll definitely get over 1,000, but...
I mean, you know, I think it should be easy being on Steam, but I frankly don't know because I never released anything on Steam before. I'm not familiar with the marketplace yet.
It seems like it would be sympathetic, just from what I know. I haven't released anything on Steam either, but just like the vibe that I get from people, you know, voting on Greenlight projects and other things is just that, you know, they want a deep experience that with, you know, with a decent amount of hours to it and, like, you know, some characters that they can get behind and, you know, just in some ways very traditional sort of wants from a gamer.
That is true. I mean, around the time when people on Greenlight were just being super nasty and bashing other people's games, and I was just like, oh, God. People were just leaving really nice comments on my Greenlight all the time, and I was like, I feel kind of guilty, but I guess they like it. So yeah, I mean, you might be right. Steam might be just a receptive place for that sort of game.
Mm-hmm.
And you've basically been in kind of like a, not official early access, but kind of early access for a while now. So you've had time to kind of refine and iterate based off user feedback, right?
Not Steam early access. I've actually avoided that because
not the Steam early access.
But you've
given
beta to backers and.
And there's also a way to buy now on your site, right, to get into...
Yeah. So, I mean, there was an early access tier in the Kickstarter, so everyone that pledged $25 and up got a copy of the game, like, within a couple of weeks of the Kickstarter ending. And, you know, that ended in, like, April 2013. So they've had it for a couple of years now, while everyone else has had to wait. But... You know, then, like, after the Kickstarter, there were people who were like, oh, man, I missed the Kickstarter. I want to get an early access copy. So I was like, all right, tell you what. I'll just make it available to people that want to buy it through my site. So, I just made it available at the same price as the early access tier. And, you know, there have been a number of people who've got on the site and purchased it that way. But I didn't want to put it on Steam early access because, you know, it's a linear, story-driven game.
Mm.
Like, it has replay value, but it's not like an indie roguelike or something. It's not like Sunless Sea or Darkest Dungeon where, you know, you can just play it forever and it'll never get even a little old, you know? Mm. It's not the sort of evergreen replay experience that I think Steam Early Access lends itself to.
Although it does have things in common with sort of the prototypical evergreen game chess.
Ah!
Because it is a deterministic tactics game. Anyway, digression.
Yeah. Well, now that you're kind of at the end of the tunnel, like, any advice for people who are kind of like maybe in the mid or getting to the late stage, like how they can get there, and two, any ideas for projects after?
Oh yeah. How to finish a game? You mean?
Yeah. How to finish a game?
How to finish. Fix all the major bugs. Make sure you have an ending. Have a marketing plan. And make yourself release it. That's pretty much
it.
There's
just a point where you have to force
yourself,
right?
Yeah, like, it, you know, there's that old saying, a game is never really finished, you just finish working on it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point you just have to say, this is good enough to release. And you release it.
What was that originally said about? Was it books or films? I don't think it was games.
No, I'm pretty sure it didn't start with games. Probably novels. I don't know. I have no idea.
One of those old art forms that's dead now.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you could be...
Digital update? Anyway.
Yeah. You could be Jonathan Blow and The Witness, but you don't want to do that.
I'm
because...
still waiting for House of Green Gables DLC. Anne of Green Gables. Oh, I screwed up. House of Seven Gables, Anne of Green Gables. Two books conflated. Sorry.
Twice the Gables.
They're in a humble DLC. Gable bundle.
That was good. Well
thanks.
And future projects. Anything you have that you want to tease out right now?
Man, I have three or four game ideas that I've had percolating for years, and I really want to start working on one of them, or actually there's a few I really want to work on, but I just have to pick one, I guess. I'm not really ready to announce yet, but I will say that the two projects I'm most likely to choose between would both be building on the Telepath Tactics engine.
Mm.
Okay. Interesting.
Smart. Again, back to the business thing.
Well,
is that you're sort of like amortizing your costs over multiple games.
The game outcomes process, which I talked about on the last pod, one of the factors in, like, is your game successful using existing engine is a huge boost in the statistics of whether your game succeeds or not. So, kudos. Yeah,
right,
great
on.
Idea.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we are getting close to our time. We should probably kick into the What We're, which is our only regular segment. But it's, for those who haven't heard it, it's what we're consuming media-wise. It can be anything from books to movies to games to whatever, so.
What We're. I just made that little segment switching noise.
So, do you want to get us started?
Oof. Well... to be honest, I've basically been living, eating, breathing, and sleeping telepath tactics anytime I'm not at work or with the girlfriend, just because I have to do that to get it done while having a day job.
I will point out that you and I both read the same article on Kotaku today about making video games,
yes.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah, the Anthony Birch one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I actually very... So, Anthony Birch basically talks about how he didn't know all these things about how making video games were hard, was hard, and that he shouldn't have been so critical when he was a reviewer. And I had a lot of thoughts that you did, and that a lot of the stuff that he talked about doesn't really apply to what indies are doing. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of, like, the kind of big studio stuff that becomes an issue, but it didn't resonate. So I had a friend that posted up, and he works for a bigger studio, and it kind of like resonated for him, and it didn't resonate as much for me. Some of the stuff was like, this just doesn't feel like it applies.
I feel like his overall point really resonated. At least
the big point is good.
Yeah, but but the details he used to back it up were like, yeah, I'm not really feeling that, but sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure at your studio those are things that make it super difficult. You know, indies have their own struggles that make making games super challenging.
Yeah, maybe we could do a post about... So we have this new feature that we're running called the 10, where we collect 10 thoughts on something we talk about the pod. So maybe we could do a 10 on like things that indie studios face in development that we can post as a counter to that. So.
Yeah,
right on.
Here we go?
Sure. Let's see. Well, I just finished a book called A Face Like Glass, but I also just watched a really bad interview with Edmund McMillan.
Oh, no.
I think would be more fun to talk about.
Okay.
So, in Edmund McMillan talks about sort of all the problems he's had with publishers, especially Microsoft, and he draws this big spectrum from like art on one side and business on the other side, and that art is about truth and about that business is about lies and that business corrupts everything. This is basically like his point of view. Mm-hmm. And it might be a useful point of view to him, but it just rankled me, especially in the context of this podcast, which I was about to do. Mm-hmm. When I was watching. And just sort of putting those two things opposed to one another really makes me mad. I mean, like, even, I don't know, there's something from The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson where he talks about how everything great has been made by three people. There's mm-hmm. the artist, business person, and the technician, basically. So, like, the technician builds a platform on which an artist can make a work of art, and then a business person has to, sell it to people.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, it's a tree falls in the forest, man. If Meat Boy was never played by anyone, would it be as good? I don't think it would be.
Yeah.
It would certainly not be popularly conceived as being as good. That's a really weirdly Manichaean way to conceptualize the whole developer ecosystem. Like, you know, art may be about truth, but starving to death sure isn't.
I mean, I'm an engineer, right? So from my perspective, the business side is just one of the constraints, right? The constraints are what make projects interesting, really. Because if you don't have constraints, then you it's just pie in the sky, right? It doesn't mean anything. And, like, I like constraints. I mean, no one really likes constraints on certain things, right? You always want to have more budget. You always want to have more time. But constraints make it so that you actually build something real, right? The world operates inside constraints. So that's what allows us to actually build things.
It also occurred to me that, like, Meat Boy, while maybe he didn't think of it this way in the beginning, is a very commercial game. I mean, it's like, it's got the nostalgia factor of being, like, very difficult and being a platformer. But it's got, like, cute characters, but it also has, like, a dark side. It's, like, very marketable game.
On the other hand, the main villain is a fetus in a jar, so, you know.
That's true.
And, you know, and then there's, you know, The Binding of Isaac, which is very much not cute and cuddly. Like, I think, I mean, I've been following Edmund McMillen for a really long time.
Binding of Isaac didn't take off until after Meat Boy, even though it was made before Meat Boy.
That is true. He did have the whole celebrity status going for him at that point. But, I mean, I've been following Edmund McMillen for a really long time, just by, you know, virtue of starting off in the Flash community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember when
he... Yeah, Newgrounds, I mean, you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I remember when he, like, put out Triacnid and, you know, a game whose name I will not now mention on the podcast because it will be bleeped out. you know, he clearly has, like, a style of expression that's not... commercially viable, or at least wouldn't be without the right marketing savvy. And, you know, I think to some extent he might not like the business side. I can totally see why. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah,
I frequently don't like the business side, but it's kind of a necessity because, you know, as you put it, you know, if a tree falls, right, like, why would you go to all the trouble of making this game and not put it in front of as many people as you can who you think will appreciate it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even if it's just as, like, even if you don't care about money, the way to get it in front of the most people is to sell it. If you make it free, no one is going to see it. At least in the current sort of state of our market.
Yeah.
Anywho, that was my what were.
My what were quick is I've been watching the new Ghost in the Shells that just came out.
Arise,
yep. I mean, and they're really great for what I'm doing because it's cyberpunk and I'm making a cyberpunk game. But fortunately, the animation is so cool that every time I watch it, it makes me want to go and, like, tear down all my artwork and redo it again. But it has been super inspirational. And hopefully you'll see some of that reflected in the gameplay coming up. So
sweet. Nice. Can't wait.
We should give out a shout to our pod sponsors. As Craig mentioned, we're getting to con season.
Yes.
Which
GDC
means that you'll
is
need,
next week.
You'll need print stuff. You'll need cards. You'll need t-shirts. If you go to our sponsor, InnoPrints, that's ionoprints.com. and enter the coupon code CGS, you will get 15% off your first order. So
that is a sizable percent.
And secondly, we are also getting close to tax season. And if you're, there's a great spreadsheet from, I think, Business Week that just says, if you're a small company, get someone else to do your taxes. And
absolutely.
If you're in the Chicagoland area, I have a great recommendation. It's Ledger General. And if you give Marty a call and mention that you heard about us on the pod, you'll get a 3.5-hour consult. So no risk. Just give him a call. Tell him that you're running a small bootstrapped operation.
Say help, corporate taxes are due in March.
Yep.
And it's February.
Tax season and tax season.
Tax and tax.
Whoa.
And we should give your info one more time.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I'm Craig Stern. You can follow me on Twitter at @SinisterDesign. IndieRPGs.com, you can find at IndieRPGs.com. And my game developer website is SinisterDesign.net.
And can they sign up to get an email when Telepath Tactics comes out, or...?
Yes.
How can they be notified? When I want these people
Twitter,
to buy your game.
Yes, I want them to also. probably the best thing to do would be, well, first of all, if you're going to PAX East, definitely stop by the booth because I will actually be collecting emails there for a big email send out thing. I don't know. I guess I should probably make some way for people to sign up for some sort of newsletter of some kind.
I don't know.
They want to play it now. They can just go to sinister.design.net and buy it.
That is true. You could do that.
Just do that.
Just go buy it. I know it sounds great, right? Just go buy it and play it.
Okay, so I thought of a thing. You could go to the Steam page for Telepath Tactics and put it on your wish list. And then Steam will notify you when
yes,
it's out.
Yes, this is what I'm talking about.
So that's a thing. Also, if you sign up for the RSS feed on Sinister Design, there's like a little orange button on the homepage that says RSS.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. If you click it and sign up for it,
and
then
you have an RSS reader.
Then, well, I think you can just have it email you, whenever I do a new post. So if, you know, whenever the game releases, I will do a post, and it will show up in your inbox as, hey, guess what? It's out.
Nice.
Cool.
All
we'll
right.
We'll definitely link those up on our page as well.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was fun.
Yeah. And so this Friday or next Friday, we'll have a new Game Tour 10, probably talking about what we just discussed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Kyuan Hong. At Kyuan Hong.
And I'm Rob Lockhart at Bobby Locks, BobbyLox.
And don't forget to follow us, this show on Twitter at CGS Pod.
This has been episode 10.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.